For 2 days he lay unconscious in a Juneau hospital. The owner of the bar reluctantly came forward and admitted he had no paperwork on the man. Just a name, Lonnie Clark. A detective was hanging around, and when it became apparent he might never wake up, a plan was hatched. The owner told them which flophouse Lonnie called home, and the cops broke in. Along with almost nothing in the way of assets, they found 30 kilos of cocaine, wrapped neatly in foil, and seemingly untouched. Under the mattress, they also found a small plastic binder with a zipper. Inside was about $2,000 in cash, an Alaska driver's license that turned out to be fake, name of Harry Mendoza, a passport, also fake, for Albert Johnson, another fake passport for Charles Noland, a stolen Wisconsin driver's license for Wilson Steglitz, expired, and a yellowed naval discharge summary for one Ansel F. Hubbard, dated May 1955. The binder consisted of Lonnie's worldly assets, discounting, of course, the cocaine, which had a street value of roughly $1.5 million. It took the police several days to verify records and such, and by then Lonnie was awake and feeling better. The police decided not to approach him about the coke until he was ready to be discharged. They kept an officer in street clothes outside his room. Since the only legitimate names in his arsenal appeared to be Ansel F. Hubbard and Wilson Steglitz, they entered them into the National Crime Computer System to see what, if anything, might turn up. The detective began chatting with Lonnie, stopping by and bringing him milkshakes, but there was no mention of the drugs. After a few visits, the detective said they could find no records of a man named Lonnie Clark, birthplace and date, Social Security number, state of residence. Anything, Lonnie? Lonnie, who'd spent a lifetime running and ducking, grew suspicious and less talkative. The detective asked, "You ever know a man by the name of Harry Mendoza?" "Maybe," Lonnie replied. "Oh, really? From where and when? How? Under what circumstances?" "Nothing." "What about Albert Johnson or Charles Noland?" Lonnie said maybe he had met those men long ago, but wasn't sure. His memory was foggy, coming and going. He had, after all, a cracked skull and a bruised brain, and, well, he couldn't remember much before the fight. Why all the questions? By then, Lonnie knew they had been in his room, but he wasn't sure if they had found the cocaine. There was an excellent chance the man who owned it went to the flophouse not long after the fight and removed it himself. Lonnie was not a dealer. He was just doing a friend a favor, one for which he was to be paid nicely. So the question was whether the cops had found the cocaine. If so, Lonnie was in some serious trouble. The less he said, the better. As he had learned decades earlier, when the cops start asking serious questions, deny, deny, deny. Jake was at his desk when Portia rang through and said, "It's Albert Murray." Jake grabbed the phone and said hello. Murray ran a firm out of D.C. and specialized in locating missing persons, both nationally and internationally. So far, the estate of Seth Hubbard had paid the firm $42,000 to find a long-lost brother and had almost nothing to show for it. Its results had been thoroughly unimpressive, though its billing procedures rivaled those of any big city law firm. Murray, always skeptical, began with, "We have a soft hit on Ansel Hubbard, but don't get excited." He relayed the facts as he knew them, an assumed name of Lonnie, a bar brawl in Juneau, a cracked skull, lots of cocaine, and fake papers. "He's 66 years old and dealing drugs?" Jake asked. "There's no mandatory retirement age for drug dealers." Thanks. Anyway, Murray continued, this guy is pretty crafty and won't admit to anything. How bad is he hurt? He's been in the hospital for a week. He'll go from there to the jail, so his doctors are in no hurry. A cracked skull is a cracked skull, if you say so. The locals there are curious about the discharge paperwork from the Navy. It appears to be authentic, and it doesn't really fit. A fake driver's license and a fake passport might take you places, but a discharge that's 30 years old? Why would a con man like this need it? Of course, it could be stolen. So we're back to the same old question, Jake said. How do we verify him if we find him? You got it. There were no helpful photos of Ansel Hubbard. In a box in Seth's closet, they had found several dozen family photos, mainly of Ramona, Herschel, and Seth's first wife. There were none from Seth's childhood. Not a single photo of his parents or younger brother. Some school records tracked Ansel through the ninth grade, and his grainy, smiling face appeared in a group photo taken at the Palmyra Junior High School in 1934. That photo had been enlarged, along with several of Seth as an adult. Since Ansel had not been seen in Ford County in 50 years, there was not a single person who could offer an opinion as to whether he favored his older brother as a child or looked completely different. Do you have someone in Juneau? Jake asked. No, not yet. I've talked to the police twice. I can have a man there within 24 hours. What's he going to do when he gets there? If Lonnie Clark is not talking to the locals, why would he talk to a complete stranger? I doubt if he would. Let me think about it. Jake hung up and thought about nothing else for an hour. It was the first lead in months, and such a weak one at that. The trial started in 4 days, and there was no way he could race off to Alaska and somehow verify the identity of a man who did not want to be identified. Indeed, one who had apparently spent the past 30 years changing identities. He walked downstairs and found Lucian in the conference room, studying index cards with the jurors' names in bold letters. They were arranged neatly on the long table, alphabetized, all 97 of them. They were rated on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most attractive. Many of them had not yet been rated because nothing was known of the jurors. Jake replayed the conversation with Albert Murray. Lucian's first response was, "We're not telling Judge Attlee. Not yet, anyway. I know what you're thinking. If Ansel's alive, and we might know where he is, then let's scream for a continuance and buy some more time. That's a bad idea, Jake."
I wasn't thinking about that.
There's a good chance the old boy might be locked up for the rest of his life. He couldn't show up for a trial if he wanted to.
No, Lucian. I'm more concerned with verification. There's no way to do it unless we go talk to him. Keep in mind, he has a chunk of money on the line here. He might be more cooperative than we think. Lucian took a deep breath and began pacing around the table. Portia was too inexperienced, and she was also a young black female, not the type to pry secrets out of an old white man who was running from something, or everything. That left him, the only available member of the firm. He walked to the door and said,
"I'll go. Get me all the information you can."
"Are you sure, Lucian?" There was no response, as he closed the front door behind himself. Jake's only thought was, "I hope he can stay sober." Ozzie stopped by late Thursday afternoon for a quick visit. Harry Rex and Portia were in the war room, poring over juror names and addresses. Jake was upstairs at his desk, on the phone, wasting time, trying to track down a few more of Wade Lanier's 45 witnesses. So far, the task had been frustrating.
"Want a beer?"
Harry Rex asked the sheriff. A fresh Bud Light sat nearby.
"I'm on duty, and I don't drink," Ozzie replied.
I hope you're not driving. I'd hate to see you busted for a DUI.
I just hired Jake to postpone it forever. You got some names?
Ozzie handed him a sheet of paper and said,
A few. That Oscar Peltz guy we were talking about yesterday, from down near Lake Village, well, he goes to the same church with the Rosten family.
Portia picked up the card with Oscar Peltz written in a black marker across the top.
I'd stay away from him, Ozzie said.
Harry Rex looked at his notes and said,
We had him as a 5 anyway. Not too attractive.
Mr. Raymond Griffiths lives down from Parker's Country Store, south of here. What do you have on him?
Portia picked up another card and said, White male, age 41, works for a fencing contractor. Harry Rex added,
Divorced, remarried, father died in a car wreck about 5 years ago.
Ozzie said,
Stay away from him. I got a source says his brother was involved with the Klan 3 years ago during the Haley trial. Don't think the brother ever joined up, but he was a bit too close. They might be presentable on the surface, but could be a rough bunch.
I had him as a 4, Harry Rex said. I thought you were after all the black folks.
That's a waste of time. All black folks get automatic 10s in this trial.
How many are on the list, Portia?
21 out of 97.
We'll take them.
Where's Lucian? Ozzie asked.
Jake ran him off. Any luck with Pernell Phillips? You thought Moss Jr. might know him.
He's Moss Jr.'s wife's third cousin, but they try to avoid family gatherings. Backwater Baptist. He wouldn't get too many points from me.
Portia? Let's give him a 3,
she said with the authority of a veteran jury consultant.
That's the problem with this damn pool, Harry Rex said. Far too many 3s and 4s, not enough 8s and 9s. We're going to get clobbered.
Where's Jake? Ozzie asked.
Upstairs, fighting the phone.
Lucian drove to Memphis, flew to Chicago, and from there flew all night to Seattle. He drank on the flight, but went to sleep before being excessive. He killed 6 hours in the Seattle airport, then caught a 2-hour flight to Juneau on Alaska Air. He checked into a hotel downtown, called Jake, slept 3 hours, showered, even shaved, and dressed himself in an old black suit that hadn't been worn in a decade. With the white shirt and paisley tie, he could pass himself off as a lawyer, which was exactly what he planned to do. With a battered briefcase in hand, he walked to the hospital. 22 hours after leaving Clanton, he said hello to the detective and got the latest scoop over coffee. The update revealed little. An infection was causing his brain to swell, and Lonnie was not in the mood to talk. His doctors wanted things quiet, and the detective had not spoken to him that day. He showed Lucian the fake paperwork they found in the flophouse, along with the naval discharge. Lucian showed the detective 2 enlarged photos of Seth Hubbard. Maybe there was a vague resemblance, maybe not. It was a long shot. The detective called the owner of the bar and insisted he come to the hospital. Since he knew Lonnie well, he could look at the photos. He did, and saw nothing. After the owner left, and with little else to do, Lucian explained to the detective the purpose of his visit. They had been looking for Ansel for 6 months, but it had been a cold trail. His brother, the one in the photos, had left him some money in a will. Not a fortune, but certainly enough to scramble Lucian from Mississippi to Alaska overnight. The detective had little interest in a lawsuit so far away. He was more concerned with the cocaine. No, he did not believe Lonnie Clark was a drug dealer. They were about to crack a syndicate out of Vancouver, and they had a couple of informants. The buzz was that Lonnie was simply hiding the stuff for a fee. Sure, he would serve some time, but time measured in months and not years. And no, He would not be allowed to travel back to Mississippi for any reason, if in fact his name was really Ansel Hubbard. After the detective left, Lucian roamed around the hospital to familiarize himself with the maze of corridors and annexes and split levels. He found Lonnie's room on the third floor and saw a man standing nearby, flipping through a magazine, trying to stay awake. He assumed he was an officer. After dark, he returned to his hotel, called Jake for the update, and went to the bar. It was either his fifth or sixth night in this damp, dark room with windows that never opened and somehow blocked out all light during the day. The nurses came and went, sometimes tapping softly on the door as they pushed it open, and other times appearing at his bedside without making a sound to warn him. He had tubes in both arms and monitors above his head. He had been told he wouldn't die. But after 5 or 6 days and nights with virtually no food but plenty of meds and too many doctors and nurses, he wouldn't mind a prolonged blackout. His head pounded in pain, and his lower back was cramping from the inactivity, and at times he wanted to rip off all the tubes and wires and bolt from the room. A digital clock gave the time as 11:10. Could he leave? Was he free to walk out of the hospital, or were the goons waiting just outside his door to take him away? No one would tell him. He had asked several of the friendlier nurses if someone was waiting, but all responses had been vague. Many things were vague. At times the television screen was clear, and then it would blur. There was a constant ringing in his ears that made him mumble. The doctors denied this. The nurses just gave him another pill. There were shadows at all hours of the night, observers sneaking into his room. Maybe they were students, looking at real patients. Maybe they were just shadows that did not really exist. They changed his meds frequently to see how he would react. Try this one for the pain, this one for the blurred vision, this one for the shadows. This one is a blood thinner. This is an antibiotic. Dozens and dozens of pills, and at all hours of the day and night. He dozed off again, and when he awoke, it was 11:17. The room was pitch black. The only light, a red haze cast off from a monitor above his head, one he could not see. The door opened silently. But no light entered from the dark hallway. But it wasn't a nurse. A man, a stranger, walked straight to the side of the bed. Gray hair, long hair, a black shirt, an old man he had never seen before. His eyes were squinted and fierce, and as he leaned down even closer, the smell of whiskey almost slapped Lonnie in the face. He said, "Ansel, what happened to Sylvester Rhines?" Lonnie's heart froze as he stared in horror at the stranger, who gently placed a hand on his shoulder. The whiskey smell grew stronger. He repeated, "Ansel, what happened to Sylvester Rhines?" Lonnie tried to speak, but words failed him. He blinked his eyes to refocus, but he was seeing clearly enough. The words were clear, too, and the accent was unmistakable. The stranger was from the deep south. "What?" Lonnie managed to whisper, almost in a gasp. "What happened to Sylvester Rhines?" the stranger repeated, his laser-like eyes glowing down at Lonnie. There was a button on the bedstead that summoned a nurse. Lonnie quickly punched it. The stranger withdrew, became a shadow again, then vanished from the room. A nurse eventually arrived. She was one of his least favorites and didn't like to be bothered. Lonnie wanted to talk, to tell her about the stranger, but this gal was not a listener. She asked what he wanted, and he said he couldn't go to sleep. She promised to check back later. The same promise as always. He lay in the dark, frightened. Was he frightened because he had been called by his real name? Because his past had caught up with him? Or was he frightened because he wasn't sure he had actually seen and heard the stranger? Was he finally losing his mind? Was the brain damage becoming permanent? He faded away, drifting in and out of blackness, sleeping for only a moment or two before thinking of Sylvester. Chapter 37. Jake walked into the coffee shop at 7:05 on Saturday morning, and as usual, the conversation lagged for a few seconds as he found a seat and swapped a few insults. The trial started in 2 days, and according to Dell, the early morning chatter was dominated by rumors and endless opinions about the case. The subject was changed the moment Jake walked in each morning, and as soon as he left, it was as if someone flipped a switch and Seth's will was again front and center. Though her customers were all white, they seemed to be divided into several camps. There were strong opinions that a man in his right mind should be able to give away his property as he pleased, regardless of his family. Others argued he wasn't in his right mind. Letty had her share of detractors. She was widely believed to be a loose woman who took advantage of poor old Seth. Jake stopped by at least once a week when the cafe was empty and got the lowdown from Dell. Of particular interest was a regular named Tug Whitehurst, a state meat inspector. His brother was on the jury list, though she was certain Tug had not mentioned this. He wasn't much of a talker, but during one conversation he did side with Carrie Hall when Hall declared it was no one's business how he left his estate. Hall was notoriously broke and in debt, and everyone knew his estate would be a disaster. But this was allowed to pass without comment. At any rate, Dell thought Tug Whitehurst would be okay with Jake, but who knew about his brother? At this point in the case, Jake was desperate for any information about the chosen 97. He sat at a table with a couple of farmers and waited on his grits and toast. Bass fishing dominated the conversation, so Jake had little to offer. For at least the last 3 years, a great debate had raged in certain circles over whether the largemouth bass population in Lake Chitula was declining or increasing. Opinions were strong and loud, and there appeared to be no room for compromise. Experts were plentiful. Just as the tide shifted in favor of a dwindling population, someone would land a trophy and the debate would fire up again. Jake was weary of the topic, but now thankful for it nonetheless. It kept attention away from the Hubbard case. As he was eating, Andy Furr asked,
"Say, Jake, is the trial still a go for Monday?"
"It is."
"So no chance of a postponement or anything like that?"
"I don't see one. The prospective jurors will be there at 9, and we should get started soon after. You coming?"
"No. Gotta work. Y'all expecting a crowd?"
"You never know. Civil trials tend to be fairly dull. We may start off with some spectators, but I suspect they'll disappear quickly."
Dell topped off his coffee and said,
"The place will be packed, and you know it. We haven't had this much excitement since the Haley trial."
"Oh, I forgot about that one," Jake said, and got a few laughs.
Bill West said he had heard the FBI had just raided the offices of 2 supervisors down in Polk County, a notoriously corrupt place, and this ignited a round of condemnation from almost everyone but Jake and Dell. It also changed the subject, and for that, Jake was grateful. At that moment, facing a long weekend at the office, all he wanted was breakfast. Portia arrived around 9 o'clock, and they had a coffee together on the balcony as the town came to life around them. she reported that she had had an early breakfast with Letty, who was nervous, even fragile and terrified of the trial. Letty was exhausted from the strain of living in a house packed with relatives, and of trying to work part-time, and of trying to ignore the fact that her husband was in jail for killing two boys. Add a pending divorce and a gut-wrenching will contest, and Letty was understandably a wreck. Portia admitted she was exhausted, too. She was working long hours at the office and sleeping little. Jake was sympathetic, but only to a point. Litigation often required 18-hour days and lost weekends, and if Portia was serious about becoming a lawyer, she needed a good dose of the pressure. In the past 2 weeks, they had pushed each other into memorizing all 97 names on the jury list. If Jake said R, then Portia responded 6, Rady, Rakestraw, Reese, Riley, Robbins, and Robard. If Portia said W, then Jake responded 3, Wampler, Whitehurst, Witten. Back and forth, the mental contest raged throughout each day. Jury selection in Mississippi was normally a one-day ordeal at most. Jake was continually fascinated by trials in other states where it took 2 weeks or a month to pick a jury. He could not fathom such a system. Neither could Mississippi judges. They were dead serious about selecting fair and impartial panels. They just didn't waste time. Speed would be crucial. Quick decisions would be required. The lawyers on both sides would not have much time to think about names or to look them up in some batch of research. It was imperative that they know the names and quickly put them with faces. Jake was determined to know every single juror and their ages, addresses, jobs, education, churches, as much info as they could gather. Once the 97 names were filed away, Portia was given the task of wading through the courthouse records. She spent hours in the deed books and land records searching for transactions over the past 10 years. She combed the court dockets, looking for plaintiffs and defendants, winners and losers. Of the 97, 16 had gone through a divorce in the past 10 years. She wasn't sure what that meant in the course of a trial over a will, but she had the knowledge anyway. One gentleman, a Mr. Eli Rady, had filed 4 lawsuits and lost them all. She checked the lien books and found dozens of claims for unpaid taxes, unpaid supplies, unpaid subcontractors. A few of their prospective jurors owed the county money for property taxes. In the tax assessor's office, she dug through property tax receipts and made a register of which jurors owned what make and model of vehicles. Not surprisingly, there were a lot of pickup trucks. The work was tedious and often mind-numbing, but she never slowed down. Never thought of quitting. After 2 weeks of living with these people, she was confident she knew them. After coffee, they grudgingly went back to work. Jake began roughing out an outline for his opening statement. Portia returned to the conference room and to her 97 new friends. At 10, Harry Rex finally rolled in with a sack full of greasy sausage biscuits straight from Claude's. He handed one to Jake, insisted he take it, then slid across an envelope.
"It's a check from your insurance company. Land, fire, and casualty. A bunch of crooked morons, so don't ever buy another policy from them, understand?" $135,000, settlement in full, and not a dime of it siphoned off for attorney's fees. So you owe me big time, buddy."
"Thanks. Since your fees are so cheap, get busy."
"I'm really tired of this case, Jake. On Monday, I'm going to help you pick the jury, then I'm out of there. I got my own cases to lose."
"Fair enough. Just be there for the selection."
Jake knew Harry Rex would, in fact, miss little of the actual courtroom testimony. Then he would park himself in the downstairs conference room each evening as they ate pizza and sandwiches and argued about what went wrong and what might happen the following day. He would second-guess every move Jake made, excoriate Wade Lanier with scathing criticism, curse the negative rulings made by Judge Attlee, offer unsolicited advice at every turn, maintain the constant gloom of losing an unwinnable case, and at times be so unbearable Jake would want to throw something at him. But he was seldom wrong. He knew the law and its intricacies. He read People like others read magazines. Without being obvious, he watched the jurors as they watched Jake, and his advice would be invaluable. Despite Seth Hubbard's rather explicit command that no other lawyer in Ford County profit from his estate, Jake was determined to find a way to channel some fees to Harry Rex. Seth wanted his last-minute handwritten will to survive all challenges, and whether he liked it or not, Harry Rex Vonner was crucial to the effort. The phone on Jake's desk started a muted ringing. He ignored it. Harry Rex said,
"Why have y'all stopped answering the phones around here? I've called 10 times this week and nobody answered."
"Porsche's been in the courthouse. I've been busy. Lucian doesn't answer the phone."
"Think of all the car wrecks and divorces and shoplifting cases you're missing. All the human misery out there trying like hell to get through."
"I'd say we're tied up right now."
"Any word from Lucian?"
"Nothing this morning, but then it's only 6 in Alaska. I doubt if he's up and about yet."
"He's probably just now getting in. You're an idiot, Jake, for sending Lucian on a road trip. Hell, he gets drunk between here and his house. Put him on the road in airport lounges, hotel bars, you name it, and he'll kill himself."
"He's cutting back. He plans to study for the bar and get reinstated."
"Cutting back for that old goat means stopping at midnight."
"When did you get so clean and sober, Harry Rex? You've been drinking Bud Light for breakfast."
"I know how to pace myself. I'm a professional. Lucian's just a drunk, that's all."
"Are you going to perfect those jury instructions or just sit here and badmouth Lucian all morning?" Harry Rex stood and began lumbering away.
"Later. You got a cold Bud Light?"
"No." When he was gone, Jake opened the envelope and studied the check from the insurance company. On the one hand, he was sad because the check represented the end of their first home. Sure, it went up in flames more than 3 years earlier, but the lawsuit against the insurance company gave Carla and him hope that it might be rebuilt. That was still possible, but unlikely. On the other hand, the check meant cash in the bank, not much by any means, but after paying off the 2 mortgages, they would net close to $40,000. It wasn't exactly unrestricted, but it did take some pressure off. He called Carla and said a small celebration was in order. Find a babysitter. Lucian sounded normal on the phone, though normal for him meant the usual scratchy voice and the pained delivery of a drunk trying to shake off cobwebs. He said their man, Lonnie Clark, had a rough night. The infection would not subside. The doctors were more concerned than the day before, and most important, he was not receiving visitors. "What are your plans?" Jake asked.
"Hang around for a while. Maybe take a road trip. You ever been out here, Jake? Pretty spectacular, with mountains on 3 sides and the Pacific right here at the door. The town's not a big place and not that pretty, but man, what scenery. I like it. I think I'll get out and explore."
"Do you think it's him, Lucian?"
"I know less than I did when I left Clinton. Still a mystery. The cops don't care who he is or what's happening back there. They've got a drug ring to break up. I like it here, Jake. I might stay a while. I'm in no hurry to get back. You don't need me in that courtroom."
Jake certainly agreed, but said nothing. Lucian continued,
"It's cool, and there's no humidity. Imagine that, Jake, a place with no humidity. I like it here. I'll keep an eye on Lonnie and chat with him when they let me.
Are you sober, Lucian?
I'm always sober in the morning. It's 10 at night when I run into trouble.
Keep in touch.
You got it, Jake. Don't worry.
They dropped off Hannah at Jake's parents in Caraway and drove an hour to Oxford, where they drove through the Ole Miss campus and soaked in the sights and memories of another lifetime. It was a warm, clear spring day, and the students were out in shorts and bare feet. They slung frisbees across the grove, sneaked beer from coolers, and soaked up the sun as it was disappearing. Jake was 35, Carla 31, and their college days seemed so recent, yet so long ago. A walk through campus always triggered a wave of nostalgia and disbelief. Were they really in their 30s? It seemed like they were students just last month. Jake avoided walking near the law school. That nightmare was not distant enough. At dusk, they drove to the Oxford Square and parked by the courthouse. They browsed for an hour in the bookstore, had a coffee on the balcony upstairs, then went to dinner at the Downtown Grill, the most expensive restaurant within 80 miles. With money to burn, Jake ordered a bottle of Bordeaux, $60. Returning at almost midnight, they took their customary turns and slowly drove by the Hocut House. Some of its lights were on, and the grand old place beckoned them. Parked in the driveway was Willie Trainer's Spitfire with Tennessee plates. Still a bit loose from the wine, Jake said, "Let's check on Willie."
"No, Jake, it's too late,"
Carla protested.
"Come on, Willie won't care."
He had stopped the sob and was shifting into reverse.
"Jake, this is so rude."
"For anyone else, yes, but not for Willie. Plus, he wants us to buy this place."
Jake parked behind the Spitfire.
"What if he has company?"
"Now he has more. Let's go."
Carla reluctantly got out. They paused for a second on the narrow sidewalk and took in the sweeping front porch. The air was rife with the fragrant aromas of tree peonies and irises. Pink and white azaleas burst forth from the flower beds.
"I say we buy it," Jake said.
"We can't afford it," she replied.
"No, but the bank can."
They stepped onto the porch, rang the bell, and heard Billie Holiday in the background. Willie eventually came to the door in jeans and a t-shirt and pulled it open with a big smile.
"Well, well," he said, "if it's not the new owners."
"We were just in the neighborhood and wanted a drink," Jake said.
"I hope we're not intruding,"
Carla said, somewhat embarrassed.
"Not at all.
Come in,"
Willie insisted as he waved them in. They went to the front parlor where he had a bottle of white wine on ice. It was almost empty, and he quickly grabbed another and uncorked it. As he did so, he explained that he was in town to cover the trial. His latest venture was the launch of a monthly magazine devoted to Southern culture, and its inaugural issue would have an in-depth story about Seth Hubbard and the fortune he had left to his black housekeeper. Willie had not mentioned this before. Jake was thrilled at the idea of some publicity outside Ford County. The Haley trial had given him a dose of notoriety, and it was intoxicating.
"Who's on the cover?" he asked, joking.
"Probably not you," Willie said as he handed over two glasses filled to the top. "Cheers."
They talked about the trial for a moment or two, but all three were having other thoughts. Finally, Willie broke the ice by saying,
"Here's what I propose. Let's shake hands tonight on the house. A verbal contract, just the three of us."
"Verbal contracts for real estate are not enforceable," Jake said.
"Don't you just hate lawyers?" Willie said to Carla.
"Most of them."
Willie said,
"It's enforceable if we say it's enforceable. Let's shake hands tonight on a secret deal. Then after the trial, we'll find a real lawyer who can draft a proper contract. You guys go to the bank and line up a mortgage, and we'll close in 90 days.
Jake looked at Carla, who looked right back. For a moment they froze, as if the idea was entirely new. In reality, they had discussed the Hocut house until they were weary of it.
"What if we can't qualify for a mortgage?" Carla asked.
"Don't be ridiculous. Any bank in town will loan you the money."
"I doubt it," Jake said. "There are five in town, and I've sued three of them."
"Look, this place is a bargain at $250, and the banks know it."
"I thought it was $225, Jake said, glancing at Carla. Willie took a sip of his wine, smacked his lips with satisfaction, and said,
"Well, yes, it was, briefly. But you didn't take the bait at that price. Frankly, the house is worth at least $400,000. In Memphis..."
"We've had that conversation, Willie. This is not Midtown Memphis."
"No, it's not. But $250 is a more reasonable price. So, it's $250.
Jake said, "That's a strange way to sell, Willie. If you don't get your price, you keep raising it?"
"I'm not raising it again, Jake, unless some doctor comes along."
"It's $250.
"That's fair. You guys know it. Now let's shake hands."
Jake and Carla stared at each other for a moment. Then she slowly reached over and shook Willie's hand.
"Atta girl," Jake said. "The deal was closed."
The only sound was the faint hum of a monitor somewhere above and behind him. The only light was the red glow of digital numbers that recorded his vitals. His lower back was cramping, and Lonnie tried to shift slightly. An IV drip kept the clear but potent meds in his blood, and for the most part, kept the pain away. In and out, he came and went. Barely awake for a few moments, then dead again. He had lost track of the days and hours. They had turned off his television and taken away his remote. The meds were so strong that not even the worrisome nurses could awaken him at all hours of the night, though they tried. When awake, he could feel movement in the room. Orderlies, housekeepers, doctors, lots of doctors. He occasionally heard them speak in low, grave voices, and Lonnie had already decided he was dying. An infection he couldn't pronounce or remember was now in control, and the doctors were struggling. In and out. A stranger appeared, without a sound, and touched the guardrail.
"Ansel," he said in a low but strong voice. "Ansel, are you there?"
Lonnie's eyes opened wide at the sound of his name. It was an old man with long gray hair and a black T-shirt. It was the same face, back again.
"Ansel, can you hear me?"
Lonnie did not move a muscle.
"Your name's not Lonnie. We know that. It's Ansel. Ansel Hubbard, brother of Seth. Ansel, what happened to Sylvester Rhines?"
Though terrified, Lonnie remained frozen. He smelled whiskey and remembered it from the night before.
"What happened to Sylvester Rhines? You were 8 years old, Ansel. What happened to Sylvester Rhines?"
Lonnie closed his eyes and breathed deeply. For a second, he was gone. Then he jerked his hands and opened his eyes. The stranger was gone. He called the nurse. Chapter 38. Before his wife died, Judge and Mrs. Attlee once went 8 consecutive years without missing Sunday worship at the First Presbyterian Church. 52 Sundays in a row for 8 years. A flu virus halted the streak. Then she passed on, and the judge lost some focus and actually missed once or twice a year. but not often. He was such a presence in the church that his absence was always noted. He wasn't there the Sunday before the trial began, and when Jake realized it, he allowed his mind to wander during the sermon. Could the old guy be sick? If so, might the trial be postponed? How would this affect his strategy? A dozen questions and no answers. After church, Jake and his girls returned to the Hocut house, where Willie was preparing a brunch on the back porch. He insisted on hosting the new owners, claiming he wanted to meet Hannah and show her around. All top secret, of course. Jake and Carla would have preferred to keep their daughter out of it for the moment, but they could hardly suppress their excitement. Hannah promised to keep this rather significant secret. After a tour, which included Hannah's tentative selection of her new bedroom, they settled around a plank farm table on the porch and had French toast and scrambled eggs. Willie moved the conversation away from the house and to the trial. Fluidly, he became a journalist again, probing and nibbling around the edges of sensitive material. Twice, Carla shot warning glances at Jake, who realized what was happening. When Willie asked if they could expect any evidence that Seth Hubbard had been intimate with Letty Lang, Jake politely said he couldn't answer that question. The brunch became a little awkward as Jake grew quieter while his host kept chatting on about rumors he was chasing. Was it true Letty had offered to split the money and settle the case? Jake replied firmly that he could not comment. There was so much gossip. When Willie pursued another question about intimacy, Carla said, "Please, Willie, there's a 7-year-old present." "Yes, sorry." Hannah was not missing a word. After an hour, Jake looked at his watch and said he had to get to the office. It would be a long afternoon and night. Willie poured some more coffee as they thanked him and placed their napkins on the table. It took 15 minutes to gracefully say goodbye. As they drove away, Hannah stared at the house through the car's rear window and said, "I like our new house. When can we move in?" "Soon, honey," Carla said. "Where's Mr. Willie going to live?"
"Oh, he has several houses," Jake said. "Don't worry about him."
"He's such a nice man." "Yes, he is," Carla said.
Lucian followed the detective into the room where Lonnie sat waiting expectantly with a stout nurse at his side, sentry-like. She was not smiling and seemed irritated by this intrusion. One of the doctors had reluctantly acceded to the request for a few questions. Lonnie's condition had improved overnight, and he was feeling better, but his team was still protective. They didn't like lawyers anyway.
"This is the guy I told you about, Lonnie," the detective said without the slightest attempt at an introduction.
Lucian, in his black suit, stood down by Lonnie's feet and offered a phony smile.
"Mr. Clark, my name is Lucian Wilbanks, and I work for a lawyer in Clanton, Mississippi," he said.
Lonnie had seen the face before, hadn't he? In the middle of the night. The face had appeared and disappeared like a ghost.
"A pleasure,"
Lonnie said, as if still groggy, though his mind had not been this clear since before the blow to his skull. Lucian said,
"We're involved in some litigation that makes it imperative that we locate a man named Ansel Hubbard. Mr. Hubbard was born in Ford County, Mississippi, on August 1st, 1922. His father was Cleon Hubbard. His mother was Sarah Bell Hubbard, and he had one brother, Seth, who was 5 years older. We've been searching high and low for Ansel Hubbard, and it's come to our attention that there's a chance you might know him, or perhaps your paths have crossed in recent years."
Lonnie said, "You've come all the way from Mississippi?"
"Sure, but it's no big deal. We have aeroplanes down there, too, and we've covered the continent looking for Ansel."
"What kind of litigation?" Lonnie asked with the same disdain most people heap on the unsavory subject.
some pretty complicated stuff. Seth Hubbard died suddenly about 6 months ago, and he left behind a mess. A lot of business interest and not much in the way of estate planning. Our job as lawyers is to first try and round up the family, which, in the case of the Hubbards, is quite a task. We have reason to believe you might know something about Ansel Hubbard. Is this right?
Lonnie closed his eyes as a wave of pain rolled through his head. He reopened them, looked at the ceiling, and said softly,
"That name doesn't ring a bell. Sorry."
As if he was either expecting this or not hearing it, Lucian went on.
"Can you think of anyone in your past who might have known Ansel Hubbard or mentioned his name? Help me here, Mr. Clark. Think back. It looks like you've moved around a lot, so you've known many people in many places. I know you got a sore head and all, but take your time. Think real hard about this."
Again he said, "That name does not ring a bell." The nurse glared at Lucian and seemed ready to pounce. He did not acknowledge her presence. He carefully sat his battered leather briefcase on the foot of the bed so Lonnie could see it. It probably contained something important. Lucian said,
"Have you ever been to Mississippi, Mr. Clark?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Sure, I'm sure."
"Well, hey, that's a real surprise, because we thought you were born there. We've paid a lot of money to some high-priced investigators who've been tracking Ansel Hubbard. When your name popped up, they took off after you and found several Lonnie Clarks. One of them was born in Mississippi 66 years ago. You are 66 years old, aren't you, Mr. Clark?"
Lonnie stared at him, overwhelmed and uncertain. Slowly he said,
"I am."
"So what's your connection to Ansel Hubbard?"
The nurse said,
"He said he didn't know him."
Lucian snapped at her,
"And I'm not talking to you. This is an important legal matter, a big case involving dozens of lawyers, several courts, and a pile of money. And if I need you to stick your nose into the middle of it, then I'll let you know. Until then, please butt out."
Her cheeks blushed crimson as she gasped for breath. Lonnie despised that particular nurse and said to her,
"Don't speak for me, okay? I can take care of myself."
The nurse, completely chastised, took a step back from the bed. Lucian and Lonnie, now joined in their contempt for the nurse, looked at each other carefully. Lonnie said,
"I'll have to sleep on it. My memory is coming and going these days. And they got me so doped up, you know." "I'll be happy to wait," Lucian said. "It's very important that we find Ansel Hubbard."
He pulled a business card from a pocket and handed it to Lonnie.
"This is my boss, Jake Brigance. You can call him and check me out. He's the lead lawyer in the case."
"And you're a lawyer too?"
Lonnie asked.
"I am. I just ran out of cards. I'm staying at the Glacier Inn on 3rd Street."
Late in the afternoon, Herschel Hubbard unlocked the door to his father's house and stepped inside. It had been empty now for how long? He paused and did the math. His father had killed himself on October 2nd, a Sunday. Today was April 2nd, a Sunday. To his knowledge, the house had not been cleaned since the day Letty was fired, the day after the funeral. A thick layer of dust covered the television console and bookcases. The smell was of stale tobacco and stagnant air. He flipped a switch and the lights came on. He had been told that Quince Lundy, the administrator, was in charge of paying the utility bills. The kitchen counters were spotless, the refrigerator empty. A faucet dripped slowly into a brown stain in the porcelain sink. He made his way to the rear of the house, and in the room he had once called his own, he slapped the bedspread to stir the dust. Then he stretched out on the bed and gazed at the ceiling. In 6 months, he had gone through the fortune several times, spending as he pleased, but also doubling and tripling it with shrewd investments. At times, he felt like a millionaire. At others, he was consumed with the awful emptiness of seeing the riches slip away and being left with nothing. Why did the old man do it? Herschel was willing to accept and shoulder more than his share of responsibility for their fractious relationship. But he could not begin to comprehend getting cut out completely. He could have loved Seth more, but then Seth gave little love in return. He could have spent more time here, in the house, but then Seth didn't want him around. Where had they gone wrong? How young was Herschel when he realized his father was cold and distant? A child can't chase a father who has no time for him. But Herschel had never fought his father, had never embarrassed him with open rebellion or worse, addictions, arrests, a life of crime. He parted with Seth when he was 18 and left home to become a man. If he neglected Seth as an adult, it was because Seth had neglected him as a little boy. A child is not born with the tendency to neglect. It has to be acquired. Herschel learned from a master. Would the money have changed things? If Herschel had known the extent of his father's wealth, what would he have done differently? One hell of a lot, he was finally admitting to himself. Initially, he had taken the high road and said, at least to his mother, that he wouldn't have changed a thing. No, sir. If Seth wanted no part of his only son, then the son would certainly allow him to have it that way. Now, though, as time passed and his own unhappy world was growing darker, Herschel knew he would have been here, in the house, taking care of his dear old dad. He would have shown an enthusiastic burst of interest in lumber and furniture. He would have begged Seth to teach him the business and possibly groom him as a successor. He would have swallowed hard and returned to Ford County, renting a place somewhere nearby, and he definitely would have kept an eye on Letty Lang. Getting shut out of such a large inheritance was so humiliating. His friends had whispered behind his back. His enemies had reveled in his misfortune. His ex-wife loathed him almost as much as she despised Seth, and she had gleefully spread the awful but true gossip around Memphis. Even though her children also got the axe, she couldn't stop herself from piling on poor Herschel. For 6 months, he had found it difficult to run his business and concentrate on his affairs. The bills and debts were adding up. His mother was becoming less sympathetic and helpful. On two occasions, she had asked him to leave her home and find another place to live. He wanted to, but he couldn't afford it. His fate now lay in the hands of a crafty lawyer named Wade Lanier, a cranky old judge named Reuben Attlee, and a haphazard gang of accidental jurors in rural Mississippi. At times he was confident justice would prevail, right over wrong and all that. It was simply wrong for a housekeeper, whatever her skin color, to appear in the final years of a long life and manipulate things in such a fiendish manner. Fairness was on their side. At other times, though, he could still feel the unspeakable pain of having it slip away. If it could happen once, it could certainly happen again. The walls inched closer, and the musty air grew thicker. It had been a joyless home with two parents who despised each other. He cursed them for a while,
both of them equally, then concentrated more on Seth.
"Why have children if you don't want them?"
But he had wrestled with these questions for years, and there were no answers.
"Let it go. Enough."
He locked the house, left it, and drove to Clanton, where he was expected around 6 p.m. Ian and Ramona were already there in the large conference room on the second floor of the Sullivan firm. Their ace jury consultant, Myron Pankey, was going on about their meticulous research when Herschel arrived. Cursory greetings and introductions were made. Pankey had two staffers with him, two attractive young ladies preoccupied with note-taking. Wade Lanier and Lester Chilcott sat at the center on one side of the table, flanked by paralegals. Pankey was saying, "Our phone survey also revealed that when given the additional facts that the will was written by a wealthy man, age 70, and the caregiver was an attractive woman much younger, over half of those surveyed asked if sex was involved. We never mentioned sex, but it's often the automatic response. What was really going on? Race was never mentioned, but of the black respondents, almost 80% were suspicious of sexual activity. Of the white, 55%.
So the issue is very much in the air, though unspoken, Lanier said.
Didn't we know this 6 months ago? Herschel asked himself as he doodled on a legal pad. So far, they had paid Pankey two-thirds of his $75,000 fee. The money was now being fronted by Wade Lanier's law firm, which was paying all the litigation expenses. Ian had chipped in $20,000. Herschel, nothing. If there was a recovery, there would also be a war dividing it. Pankey passed out thick booklets for their reading pleasure, though the lawyers had already spent hours with the material. Beginning with Ambrose and ending with Young, there was a one- or two-page summary of each juror. Many included photos of homes and automobiles, and a few had actual photos of the jurors. These were taken from church and club directories, high school yearbooks, and a few candid shots handed over on the sly by friends. Pankey was saying, "Our perfect juror is a Caucasian over the age of 50. The younger people went to integrated schools and tend to be more tolerant on race, and obviously we are not looking for tolerance. Sadly for us, the more racist, the better. White women are slightly preferable over white men, and this is because they tend to show more jealousy toward another woman who has managed to manipulate the will. A man might excuse another man for fooling around with his housekeeper, but a woman is not so understanding."
$75,000 for this?
Herschel doodled to himself.
Isn't this fairly obvious?
He shot a bored look at his sister, who was looking old and tired. Things were not going well with Ian, and the Hubbard siblings had spoken on the phone more in the past 3 months than in the past 10 years. Ian's deals were not paying off, and the strained marriage was continuing to crack. Ian spent most of his time on the Gulf Coast, where he and some partners were renovating a mall. This was fine with her. She didn't want him at home. She talked openly of divorce, to Herschel anyway. But if they lost this case, she might be stuck.
"We're not going to lose," Herschel kept reassuring her.
They slogged through the research until 7:30, when Wade Lanier said he had had enough. They drove to a fish shack overlooking Lake Chitula and enjoyed a long meal, just the lawyers and their clients. After a few drinks, their nerves were settled, and they managed to relax. Like most trial lawyers, Wade Lanier was a gifted storyteller, and he regaled them with hilarious tales from his courtroom brawls. More than once, he said,
"We're going to win, folks. Just trust me."
Lucian was in his hotel room, a Jack on the Rocks on his nightstand, his nose stuck deep into another impenetrable Faulkner novel, when the phone rang. A weak voice on the other end said,
"Is this Mr. Wilbanks?"
"It is," Lucian said, gently closing the book and swinging his feet to the floor.
"This is Lonnie Clark, Mr. Wilbanks. Please call me Lucian, and I'll call you Lonnie, okay?"
"Okay.
How are you feeling tonight, Lonnie?"
"Better. Much better."
"You came to my room last night, didn't you, Lucian?"
"I know you did."
"I thought I was dreaming last night when a stranger appeared in my room and said something to me. But then when I met you today, I recognized you, and I recalled your voice."
"I'm afraid you were indeed dreaming, Lonnie."
"No, I wasn't." "Because you came the night before, too. Friday night and Saturday night. It was you."
"I know it was."
"No one can get in your room, Lonnie. There's a cop at the door around the clock, I'm told."
Lonnie paused as if he didn't know this. Or if he did, then how could a stranger sneak into his room? Finally, he said,
"The stranger said something about Sylvester Rhines." "Do you know Sylvester Rhines, Lucian?"
"Where's he from?" Lucian asked, casually taking a sip.
"I'm asking you, Lucian. Do you know Sylvester Rhines?"
"I've lived in Ford County all my life, Lonnie. I know everyone, black and white. But something tells me Sylvester Rhines died before I was born. Did you know him?"
"I don't know. It's all so muddled now, and so long ago."
His voice faded as if he had dropped the phone. "Keep him talking," Lucian said to himself.
"I'm much more interested in Ansel Hubbard," he said. "Any luck with that name, Lonnie?"
Weakly, he said,
"I might be on to something. Can you stop by tomorrow?"
"Of course.
What time?"
"Come early. I'm not as tired in the mornings." "What time will the doctors be finished with their rounds?"
"I don't know. 9 or so."
"I'll be there at 9:30, Lonnie."
Chapter 39. Nevin Dark parked his truck facing the courthouse and checked his watch. He was early, but that was the plan. He had never before been summoned for jury duty, and he could grudgingly admit to being somewhat excited. He farmed 200 acres west of Caraway and rarely made it to Clanton. Indeed, he could not remember his last trip to the county seat. For the occasion, he wore his newest pair of starched khakis and a leather flight jacket handed down by his father, who had flown in World War II. His wife had firmly pressed his cotton shirt with buttons on the collar. Nevin was rarely this dressed up. He paused and gazed around the courthouse, looking for others who might be holding a summons. Of the case, he knew little. His wife's brother, a blowhard, had said he thought the trial was over a will that was handwritten, but beyond that, the details were scarce. Neither Nevin nor his wife subscribed to the local newspapers. They had not been to church in 10 years, so that rich source of gossip had passed them by. The summons said nothing about the type of jury service facing him. Nevin had never heard of Seth Hubbard nor Letty Lang. He would recognize the name of Jake Brigance, but only because Jake was from Caraway and the Haley trial had been so notorious. In short, Nevin was a model juror, reasonably smart, fair-minded, and uninformed. The summons was folded in his coat pocket. He walked around the square to kill a few minutes, then wandered over to the courthouse where things were getting busy. He climbed the stairs and joined the crowd milling around the large oak doors of the main courtroom. Two deputies in uniform were holding clipboards. Nevin was eventually processed through, and as he entered the courtroom, a clerk smiled and pointed to a seat on the left side.
He sat down next to an attractive lady in a short skirt, and within 2 minutes she informed Nevin that she taught school with Carla Brigance and would probably not make the cut. When he confessed he knew nothing about the case, she found it hard to believe. All the jurors were whispering away as they watched the lawyers move about with their important airs. The bench was empty. Half a dozen clerks moved papers here and there, doing little, really, but trying to justify their presence in the biggest will contest in the history of Ford County. Some of the lawyers had no connections at all, no reason to be there, but a courtroom filled with prospective jurors always attracted a few of the courthouse regulars. For example, a lawyer named Chuck Ray had no clients, no office, and no money. He occasionally checked land titles, thus he was always in the courthouse, killing enormous amounts of time, sipping free coffee from whatever office had the freshest pot, flirting with the clerks who knew him well, gossiping with every lawyer who came within earshot, and in general, just being there. Chuck rarely missed a trial. Since he had none of his own, he watched all the others. On this day, he was wearing his darkest suit, and his wingtips fairly gleamed with fresh polish. He spoke to Jake and Harry Rex, men who knew him all too well, and also to the out-of-town lawyers, who by then knew that Chuck was just another fixture. Every courthouse had them. A gentleman to Nevin's left struck up a conversation. He said he owned a fence company in Clanton and had once put up some chain link for Harry Rex Vonner's hunting dogs. He pointed and said, "That fat one over there in the bad suit, that's Harry Rex Vonner, meanest divorce lawyer in the county." "Is he working with Jake Brigance?" Nevin asked, completely clueless.
"Looks like it."
"Who are those other lawyers?"
"Who knows? There are so many lawyers around here these days. The square's full of them."
A bailiff came to life and yelled,
"All rise for the court, the Chancery Court of the 25th Judicial District of Mississippi. The Honorable Reuben V. Attlee presiding."
Judge Attlee appeared from the rear and assumed the bench while the crowd jumped to its feet.
"Please be seated," he said.
The crowd made a noisy retreat back onto the benches. He said hello and good morning and thanked the prospective jurors for being there, as if they had a choice. He explained that the first order of business was the selection of the jury, 12 jurors plus 2 alternates, and he figured that might take most of the day. At times, things would move slowly, as they often do in court, and he asked for their patience. A clerk had written each of their names on a small piece of paper and put them in a plastic bin. He would pull them out at random, and that's how the jurors would initially be seated. Once the first 50 were in place, the rest would be excused for the day, and maybe called back tomorrow if needed. The courtroom had 2 sections, right and left of a center aisle, and each section had 10 long benches that held about 10 people each. Since the courtroom was at full capacity, Judge Attlee asked the rest of the spectators to please rise and clear out the first 4 rows to his left. This took a few minutes, as people shuffled and stumbled and shoved about, uncertain where to go. Most stood along the walls. He reached into the plastic bin, extracted a name, and called out,
"Mr. Nevin Dark!"
Nevin's heart skipped a beat, but he stood and said,
"Yes, sir."
"Good morning, Mr. Dark. Would you please sit over here on the first row, far to the left, and we'll refer to you as juror number 1 for the time being."
"Certainly."
As Nevin walked down the aisle, he noticed the lawyer staring at him as if he had just shot someone. He took his seat on the empty front row. The lawyers continued to stare, all of them. Nevin Dark, white male, age 53, farmer, 1 wife, 2 adult children, no church affiliation, no civic clubs, no college degree, no criminal record. Jake rated him as a 7. He and Portia looked at their notes. Harry Rex, who was standing in a corner by the jury box, studied his notes. Their model juror was a black male or female of any age, but there weren't many in the crowd. At the contestants' table, Wade Lanier and Lester Chilcott compared their research. Their model juror was a white female, age 45 or older, someone raised in the deeply segregated Old South and not the least bit tolerant of blacks. They liked Nevin Dark, though they knew nothing more about him than Jake did. Number 2 was Tracy McMillan, a secretary, white female, age 31. Judge Attlee took his time unfolding the scraps of paper, studying the names, trying to pronounce them perfectly, allowing each to assume a new position. When the first row was filled, they moved to the second, with juror number 11, one Sherry Benton, the first black to be called forth. It took an hour to seat the first 50. When they were in place, Judge Attlee excused the others and said they should remain on standby until further notice. Some of them left, but most stayed where they were and became part of the audience.
"Let's recess for 15 minutes," the judge said, tapping his gavel, as he lifted his cumbersome frame and waddled off the bench, black robe flowing behind. The lawyers gathered into frantic groups, all chattering at once. Jake, Portia, and Harry Rex went straight to the jury deliberation room, which was empty at the moment. As soon as Jake shut the door, Harry Rex said,
"We're screwed, you know that? A bad draw. Terrible, terrible."
"Hang on," Jake said, tossing his legal pad onto the table and cracking his knuckles.
Portia said, "We have 11 blacks out of 50. Unfortunately, 4 of them are on the back row. Once again, we're stuck on the back row."
"Are you trying to be funny?" Harry Rex barked at her.
"Well, yes, I thought it was rather clever."
Jake said, "Knock it off, okay? I doubt if we make it past number 40.
"So do I," replied Harry Rex. "And just for the record, I sued numbers 7, 18, 31, 36, and 47 for divorce. They don't know I'm working for you, Mr. Brigance. And once again, I'm not sure why I am working for you, because I'm damn sure not getting paid. It's Monday morning. My office is filled with divorcing spouses, some of them carrying guns, and here I am hanging around the courtroom like Chuck Ray and not getting paid."
"Would you please shut up?" Jake growled.
"If you insist."